Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, how is Jewish life in Galicia different from that in the rest of Poland when the region was under Austrian control in the 19th century? Jonathan Weber is a British social anthropologist with special expertise on European Judaism and European Jews. He taught for 18 years at the University of Oxford, and then for 8 years was the UNESCO Chair in Jewish and Interfaith Studies at the University of Birmingham, England. In 2011, he moved to Krakow to take up a professorship at the Institute of European Studies of the Jagiellonian University. Since 1988, Professor Weber has been researching and documenting the rich history of Polish-Jewish relations and the cultural heritage of Polish Jews. He's chairman of the Galicia Jewish Museum in Kazimierz, Krakow, and a member of the International Auschwitz Council, advising, promoting, and aiding the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum in its various activities. He's author of Rediscovering Traces of Memory, The Jewish Heritage of Polish Galicia, published by the Indiana University Press in 2009. Professor Weber has been awarded the Gold Cross of Poland's Order of Merit for services to Polish-Jewish dialogue. A few weeks ago, Professor Weber spoke with us about Jewish heritage in Poland and the revival and preservation of Jewish culture in Poland today. This week, he'll tell us about the Galicia Jewish Museum, which he co-founded with photographer Chris Schwartz. Thank you very much for speaking with us again today. I'd like to speak with you about the Galicia Museum that you founded. Could you tell us why this museum was founded?
Well, essentially, we founded this museum 10 years ago in 2004 at a time when there was no Jewish museum created on the basis of Jewish input to describe the Jewish cultural heritage in Poland. Yes, there is a Polish museum called the Jewish Historical Museum, which was inside a former synagogue, the oldest synagogue building in Poland. But when we created the Galicia Jewish Museum, there wasn't another one. And I felt that it was important that, given the historical importance of Poland to the history of the Jewish people, having the largest Jewish community in the world until the 1920s, that there should be a Jewish museum which would describe Jewish Poland in a sympathetic way, which would appeal to Jewish visitors and also give sympathetic education about the Jewish experience, Polish-Jewish experience, to Polish visitors.
This museum is specifically about Galicia. Could you tell our listeners what Galicia is? Everybody hears about the Galicianers. Could you explain that a little bit? Because it's not all of Poland.
Galicia is the name of a province in Spain, of course, but it's also the name of a province of Poland. In the medieval times, there was a kingdom of Galicia, a kingdom called Kingdom of Galicia, and the name lapsed in late medieval times when Poland became a very strong kingdom, and the term Galicia was no longer used. Then, in the end of the 18th century, Poland was invaded by three empires. One empire which attacked it from the south and annexed, or occupied, southern Poland, that was Austria. Prussia occupied central and western Poland, and Russia occupied northern and eastern Poland. Now, the area which was occupied by the Austrians was renamed by the Austrians as Galicia. And they had this province for 125 years, from the end of the 18th century until the end of World War I in 1918, and it was called Galicia. That was the name of it, or in German, Galician. And it was very different from the rest of Poland. The Jews of Galicia had political rights which were very modern. The emperor, the Austrian emperor known as Franz Josef, who ruled Austria, the Austro-Hungarian empire for 50 years at the end of the 19th century, was very philo-Semitic, you might say, and offered the Jews opportunity to become modern, and they could live wherever they liked. They were, had political freedom, they had the vote, they had their own schools, they had all kinds of freedoms. And the Jews of Galicia, therefore, had a very different experience than the Jews of Russian Poland. So when people say their ancestors came from Poland, it depends what they mean. Do they mean their ancestors came from Russian Poland, namely that part of Poland which was part of the Russian or Tsarist Russian Empire, or do they mean they were from Galicia or Galicianas? And there was a lot of rivalry between Jews. I mean, the Galicianas were looked down upon by Lithuanians and Galicianas looked down on Lithuanians. It was a lot of rivalry about all kinds of things. And it was a very dense settlement of Jews in Galicia. Every village and every town had its Jewish community. There was a lot of Hasidism in Galicia. Some very important Hasidic leaders came from Galicia. And to many Jews, Galicia was very much the heartland of Polish Hasidism, shall we say. And so we decided to call our museum the Galicia Jewish Museum because it was located in Kraków, which was the second most important city of Galicia. The capital of Galicia was Lemberg, in the German name, or in Ukrainian it's called Lviv, or in Polish it's called Lwów. It has several different names. And Lwów, Lemberg, was a very important city in pre-war Poland, but after the Second World War, Polish borders changed, and eastern Poland was annexed by Ukraine, so that Lviv is now in Ukraine. And until 1989, it was part of the Soviet Union. Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union, and Jewish life there was ruthlessly suppressed and repressed. Whereas in Poland, it was not part of the Soviet Union, but it was influenced by Russia, and Jewish life under communism was not protected. But it was not as bad in Poland as it was in Ukraine. So an awful lot of Jewish cultural heritage survived in Poland, and especially in Galicia, because there was so much of it before the war. So what happened was this. I went out on my bicycle to find evidence of Jewish cultural life from before the war. This was in the early 1990s. There was no guidebooks, there was no internet, and there was no research really done at that time. And I would go from village to village and actually physically ask people, do you have a cemetery, a Jewish cemetery in your place? Do you have a synagogue? Any trace of a synagogue? And I was astonished how often people would say to me, well, they're not quite sure. Why don't you go and ask this old man? He might remember something. Or why don't you go and ask this old lady? She'll tell you more details. And slowly, slowly, I built up a huge archive. And I used to go out in the university vacations. I was teaching in England at that time, in Oxford. And I came to Poland for a week or 2 weeks and would get onto my bicycle there. There was no petrol available. You couldn't. I didn't have a car. And it was very difficult at the beginning. Later on, I had a car. And I collected this huge archive. And eventually, I was approached by a British photographer called Chris Schwartz, who lived in Brighton on the south coast of England, and he said to me, could I please give him my archive, because he'd like to go and take photographs of everything that I'd found. And I hesitated for a bit, because I wasn't sure whether this was a sensible thing to do, but in the end I agreed, and I gave him my archive, and off he went, and he took photographs of everything I'd found. And he came back with an archive of about 1,000 photographs. And he was a very good photographer. He was very proud of his photography. And it was decided that he was going to emigrate to Poland, sell his apartment in England, and put the money into founding this Galicia Jewish Museum. And it has on display a huge range of photographs which were very new to people. I was responsible for deciding on two things. The photographer decided which pictures he liked and which pictures he wanted to show. My job was to find out the best way in which to explain what these things were and to write captions for each of the pictures. After thinking about this for some time, because it wasn't easy and I had no precedent, I came up with what has turned out to be a very you know, innovative approach. I knew, and I know, that a lot of Jews have got very negative stereotypes about Poland. And that could be for all kinds of reasons, whether those are informed or not informed. Every stereotype is based on ignorance, but there is some measure of truth in every stereotype. So it's a bit like saying all Scotsmen are mean. There are a lot of mean Scotsmen, but there are a lot of very generous Scotsmen too. So you can't rely on stereotypes. What I wanted to do was to address the stereotypes and try to see what sense I could make of them. So first of all, we open our exhibition with stereotype number one, which is that there's nothing to see in Poland, it's a graveyard. It's the collapse and destruction of Jewish civilization. So we show pictures of synagogues which are in ruins, Jewish cemeteries which are in ruins, and the whole atmosphere of Jewish life here which is destroyed and in ruins. And that's how we start our exhibition. Then from there we go to stereotype number two, which is that there's plenty of things to see in Poland which is not in ruins. So we've got beautifully restored synagogues, beautifully restored cemeteries, things which look in really very good condition, and to show there is an awful lot which is left in Poland which can give a very good idea of how Jewish life was like before the Holocaust. And that, if you like, is in stark contrast to stereotype number one, which is that everything in Poland is in ruins. So already by the visitor seeing section number one of the exhibition and section number two realizes that the stereotypes that they have arrived with, that everything is in ruins, isn't true. Yes, it's partly true, but only partly true. Then we move to section three, where we show original places where the Holocaust took place. Now again, most people have heard of Auschwitz, but they don't really know that Jews were killed elsewhere as well. They were killed in forests, and they were killed in open fields, and even in town squares. And we show a lot of these places so that people can see that the Holocaust happened away from the public eye in forests. They took place in closed concentration camps such as Auschwitz or Belzec, where the most famous mass murders took place, but they also took place in public, if you like, in main city squares and so on. So that is section three of the museum, but there's still two more sections which we have, and people think to themselves, well, I've seen the first three sections, Jewish life in ruins, Jewish life where there's a lot of heritage still to be seen, and places where the Holocaust took place. What more is there to be said? Ah, well, section four is very interesting. Section four, which is how people here have coped with the tragedy and the memory of the tragedy. And what we show in section four is the full range. We show abandonment of memory, erasure of memory, synagogues which have been converted into, I don't know, furniture warehouses, where there isn't one word saying this building was a synagogue. But we also show that there are lots of other kinds of responses as well. People who put up memorials and monuments, sometimes in the villages, sometimes in the town squares. Sometimes there's an old synagogue which has been converted into a library, and the library has made an effort to restore the Hebrew inscriptions which are on the walls. And that's actually very interesting. Sometimes you see a little clump of trees in the middle of an open field where people know that that was a Jewish cemetery, and they still preserve that memory by ploughing around that site, preserving the memory that there was a Jewish cemetery there, and that's very interesting as well, and so on and so forth. So section four tries to show the full range of different kinds of responses that people have to the fact that there was once a genocide of this vanished population. Section five is about the people who do the remembering. All the other sections of our exhibition are without people, but section five is focusing specifically on the people. So we've got foreign tourists, we've got Jews on the March of the Living, we've got foreign politicians who are coming, we've got academics who are studying the subject and giving lectures and conferences on the subject, we've got survivors who come back and take part in processions. We've got students who take part in the Jewish Culture Festival and, for example, study Jewish tombstones. And we've got a whole section there showing the different kinds of people who are taking part in memory making. So, in a sense, the exhibition that we've got ends on a sort of upbeat note that, yes, there's been great tragedy and there's been great disaster and lots has fallen into ruin, but there is life stirring amongst these ruins and a lot is going on.
When was the museum originally opened?
It was opened in 2004, so that's 10 years ago. We just celebrated our 10th anniversary. We had a very big party to celebrate that. Chris Schwartz, the founder of the museum, who put his money into establishing the museum, unfortunately died of cancer 3 years after it was founded, so he's been dead for 7 years. And we remember him. There's an annual lecture in his memory and so on.
Have a lot of people visited the museum?
Yeah, we're very proud of our visitor numbers, which continue to grow. I'd have to look up the exact numbers, but we have about 30,000 visitors a year. I think the collective figures we now have is about 300,000 people have been to see our museum. I've written a book about the exhibition, and that is one of the bestsellers of the publisher who's published it and who's very pleased. I think we've sold about 4,000 copies, which is a lot of copies for a work of non-fiction. And for an academic book, it's an academic book. Normally academic books never get to sell more than 1,000 copies, but apparently 4,000 of my book have been sold. The Galicia Jewish Museum is also a cultural centre, so we have lectures there, we have concerts there, we have award ceremonies there to honour Poles who have been restoring the Jewish heritage. We have the Israeli embassy comes to the museum to give out its awards for the righteous, those people who rescued Jews during the Holocaust. Poland has got the highest number of these. We're 6,500 medals have been given out here in Poland, which is way ahead of most countries. Yes, it's true, the Jews lived here in great numbers, so you'd expect the rescuer numbers to be high, but indeed they are high, and that is very reassuring. And we have exhibitions about the rescuers. We've made a very good photographic exhibition of the rescuers in their old age, and that exhibition actually travels. It goes to lots of different countries. As indeed we have a travelling exhibition of our main permanent exhibition, which goes to a lot of different countries too. We are sending it to Australia next year. It's been in Israel, it's been in America, it's been many places already. It should be coming to Spain soon, I hope.
And there's a charming cafe, but what really impressed me, other than the museum itself, was the bookshop. I don't know how many books you have there available, but it is an overwhelming amount of books, not only on the Holocaust, but on Poland, on the Jews, on literature. How did you put that together?
Well, we made a decision early on. I'm the chairman of the museum. Chris Schwartz is dead, as I mentioned, unfortunately. So I'm the chairman, and I don't micromanage. We have directors. Our first director was Chris himself. Then, after he died, one of my PhD students, a British PhD student, became the director. And after she left, because she wanted to go back to the UK, I took the decision. I wanted to appoint a Pole to be the director. And he's been enormously successful, enormously successful. And one of the things that he and I discuss is the expansion of the bookshop. It's very important. We've got, I think we feel it's the largest bookshop in Poland on Jewish subjects, every kind of aspect, memoirs, history, photography, belles lettres, all kinds of things we have. I can't tell you the number of books we have in stock, but it's vast. And of course the bookshop is an important source of income for us. Every museum struggles to survive because the $1 that people pay to get inside the museum, even if we're 30,000 visitors a year, is nowhere near enough. We have a budget about 10 times that figure. We've got salaries for the equivalent of 15 full-time members of staff. We have a huge education department which teaches Jewish culture to local Polish school children and introduces visiting Jews to rescuers, so that we arrange a visiting group coming from Spain or France, Britain, can have the chance to meet a rescuer and hear the rescuer talking about his or her own experiences, translated, of course, for the benefit of the visitors, so they can have a first-hand experience of that encounter, which is very important. And then they can go off and buy some books, which, of course, we put a small markup on it, so it's probably cheaper to buy these things on the internet than it is from our bookstore, but those few percentage points help us to keep the place running. That's what every cultural institution has to do, to sell something, to bring in some income. Cafes, we have much competition in Krakow. There are places full of cafes. So we have to have a cafe, but most people, if they want to go for drink a lot of beer, would prefer to go to some more classic beer cellar where they can drink to their heart's content, and nightclubs and so forth. But yeah, the bookshop is very important to us.
Thank you very much. For more information about the Galicia Jewish Museum, please go to the link on this page. Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is EnglishCorner@RadioSefarad.com. See you next week.